Welcome to episode 19 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education, and the mantle.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick, and together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast. You missed something.
I forgot
there.
That. Okay. So we're recording today on Saturday, September 26th. Our last podcast was over a week ago, and we are still updating blogs and setting up a website.
Yeah, there's not much other administrative stuff.
No.
The computer's definitely up and running.
It is.
We need to get our hosting site.
Right.
So I think that's the plan for this next week.
Right. And so tomorrow I'm hoping to dig into that. Yep. Or at least start.
Yep, me too.
Okay.
I think it's going to become clear what's been happening, which is so awesome.
Yes. So it's not a bad thing.
No.
Yep. So do you want to start, or would you
So I think we decided, actually another administrative thing, we decided to bring back the minor topics.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been really loose about our different sections to the podcast.
Yes.
And we're just still trying to figure this out,
mm-hmm.
how we want to do it. And as we're figuring it out, we're just letting it just flow without too much structure. I think that's
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
hopefully not ramble, just a flow.
No. Yeah. Anyway.
Mm.
So, but we are bringing back the whole concept of minor topics, whether
right.
they really turn out to be or not, doesn't matter. It's the idea that
several things in the news hit our interest, like when we were reading science this week or on some other site.
Or maybe just something that we've discovered,
mm-hmm.
that we didn't know about or that we'd forgotten, which
right.
we think is really cool. And if the other person happens to get excited about it because of something they know about it and turns into a longer discussion, that's fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so but that is probably the first thing we should do is minor topics, because they'll tend to be short. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds great.
So, or did you had actually the blog entries first?
Well, I think I talked about it last time about Zernal and how much I enjoyed it. So I will leave that this time.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to write about building.
Right. So
anyway.
So
that's not written yet.
Start with the minor, or should we talk about our building?
No, that's going to be a major, I think. Don't you think?
Okay. Yeah, I agree. So I found a few minor topics this week that I thought were pretty cool. One was genetic engineering of a plant for cancer as a to create cancer drugs. And it was pretty cool that this one plant that's in the Himalayas, and it's a leafy plant that actually puts out proteins to for the healing process, and it's those proteins that they wanted to zero in on for the cancer drug. And it was just a really good, I thought it was a pretty neat investigation where someone just kept on digging away until they found the proteins that were responsible. So interesting find. It is in Science. I think it was out in Science last week, and there's a full article on it.
I didn't even see it.
Yeah, I noticed it because I was excited to read it, and then I forgot it in the counter when we went out for breakfast.
So let me see. The compound, or the protein, is called podophyllotoxin.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it's like, then they use that to make a cancer drug.
Right.
And then there's the American mayapple.
Right. So
what's the, why? There's something special about the Himalayan mayapple.
Right. So it's this endangered plant, and they are bioengineering it to
to work better than
to work better, to be able to harvest more of the chemical faster. And it's kind of neat that, you know, here we have an endangered plant that proves to be very important, where if we just look at general endangered, you know.
I don't suppose you saw if they used CRISPR.
No, I did not. I didn't read the article because I wanted this to read the article this week.
Yeah, this was a news story.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll come back then.
Yeah, well, there's a full article on our table just ready to dig into from a magazine.
Oh, is that the science that we haven't
opened
yet?
Yeah, that's the one that I wanted to take with us when we went for breakfast this morning. That's why I keep on saying, oh, we'll probably talk about that later.
Well, no wonder I didn't
turn it into a blog.
Yeah. I'm 1 week late in opening the science and downloading it.
But it was just one of those things that caught my eye. And I found, right before the podcast, another CRISPR article. And it's just a very short news article that they have actually created a new, what would you call it, Pat? A new, what is the, you know, the Cas9, that's your, what would you call that part?
Oh, I don't remember the whole mechanism anymore. Sorry.
I do remember, well, I don't remember it, but I did have it. But anyway, there's CRISPR-Cas9, and now they've just created CPF1 that works well with CRISPR. And the interesting thing about it is that it requires a smaller helper RNA. And so with a smaller amount of RNA, it's less costly. Mm-hmm. And they think that it's going to be just as precise or even more precise. Who knows? They have to do further
when we were talking
research.
Earlier, you seemed to think that it might be more precise.
Yeah, at first I thought that, but I still think they have to do more data collection to make sure. They were able to...
That's another one I didn't see.
Yeah, well, this one we will see in the next issue of Science.
The next one.
Yeah.
So that's only
so this is just
as news right now.
Yeah, it's just as news right now. But I thought it was very interesting, and it's just... it's a field that's really...
So you started looking, like collecting materials to do a little bit of a project on CRISPR.
Right, right. And
how's that going?
I've been reading a bit about it. I haven't really...
You'll have to feed me the articles now that...
Right. I actually found an overview in Science. It's a Science ebook that they put out on CRISPR and Cas9, and all it does is it goes over what it is and how it can be used in very simple terms, so someone that's not in the field can read about it and have a better understanding about what it can do and what the potential is for it. And then it's in the ebook they've also placed all the articles that have been that have used CRISPR-Cas9 in them as well. And
their finding. Which now must be like more than you can count.
Right. Well, okay, they didn't put all of them. They probably put a few.
The classics.
Classics.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I'm still working away at it. I did read about it this week. But, you know, it's one of those topics that I just need to read a lot more about to really get a good grip on. And actually, that's why I'm hoping to write a blog on. Soon. So
I'm looking forward to reading it.
Yeah.
And the articles you're going to send my way.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So, and then I had another minor topic that I was kind of excited about because right now we're doing water quality in class. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always looking through for anything that has to do with water quality so I can tell the kids. And this one talks about, you know, nitrates and the increase, you know, when we have nitrate loads in fresh water, it's a potential to lead to algal blooms and and really eutrophic conditions.
Do you remember, like, it was like last year or the year before, there was this big thing about nitrogen versus phosphorus.
Right.
And some studies that were really interesting about, in some situations, it's nitrogen that's limiting, and some it's phosphorus.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually on purpose contaminating some lakes up in Canada, I think it was, and doing experiments to figure out what was happening. I mean, this, they're not gigantic lakes, right?
It was,
some people were like,
it's so wrong.
How can, yeah. No, but it, in a way, it's like, how do you find out?
I know.
And,
I know.
And, you know, you figure if it's controlled, and then you turn it around.
It's a swimming pool.
Anyway.
Okay. So here's an interesting fact is
I
that.
I can't remember. Anyway, yeah, what's the uranium?
So this thing? Is the nitrogen they found is actually increases the mobility of uranium in groundwater. So that's kind of strange. So as our, from what I understand, and it's a very short little blurb about it, is that when our aquifers get low and the nitrogen concentrations are a little higher, it causes the uranium to
be more soluble.
To be more soluble.
So it flows through.
Yeah.
Binds to the rock less.
Right. And so that's, you know, that's one of those things that, wow, when you think of the synergetic response of those two chemicals together, or the combination of those two chemicals, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
But anyway.
They're two so different things.
Yeah, they are. And it's just, it just kind of caught my eye, and I thought it was worth mentioning, especially since we're doing water quality right now in class.
Yeah.
So.
Is there likely to be an article coming in the future about that? Or?
I don't know. So I have to go back through and see if I can find it. That's another one that I just found. So
it looks like it's in Environmental Science Technology Letters or something.
Yeah.
Can't tell from the abbreviations.
Right. And it's just a more recent one.
Yeah.
Yep. So, interesting. And finally, my other one.
That is it. The uranium and nitrogen.
Yep. But
is there still another?
Yeah, there's one more that's very short, but I thought was kind of interesting.
What were you at edge states of atomic? What were you underlining there?
Oh, so I did find another one. But visualizing the edge states of an atomic system. That's really kind of cool. So they were in this small little
This is a simulation.
Blurb. Yeah, it showed a simulation that they were making of the edge of an atom and looking at the electrons.
Uh-huh.
And it just caught my eye. So.
And they're modeling actual quantum phenomena,
right,
not just the classic.
Right. So they obtained skipping orbitals by causing magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
They can create skipping orbitals. And I thought that was kind of cool. And they were explaining how they skip along the surface. And in the picture, you can see how they're going down the surface. But anyway, it just caught my eye and I had to read about it, because that's usually something that you find and you're like, whoa.
I was like, this is not a Kelly topic.
I know. I thought, I was like, well, when you start talking about it, I'll be like, I read something about that. Okay. So, and I think I'll call it right there.
Okay.
I did have another one about batteries and battery flow, but honestly,
we're getting back into batteries,
right?
This
and,
is the first
and that's
time
why I thought, oh, I'll read this, you know, I'll just share it. And it's talking about trying to think of better storage systems, and I think I need to read more on that area to
before
really
we cover
give
it. Yeah,
because
I'd be really psyched
the clip
to get into that.
I read just wasn't enough information for me really to have a good insight
let's call
of what's going on.
For that.
So, and then I found.
Oh, that's a minor.
Yeah.
Minor. My, yeah. Major.
Yeah. Do you want to do yours?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a bunch of them.
Okay.
A new Linux Voice came out.
Nice.
And I haven't had a chance to read practically anything out of it. But this interview, interview of Matthew Garrett, Graham Morrison did the interviewing. He's the editor of Linux Voice. It caught my eye because you got so interested in that science article about privacy. And you remember a while back? I can't remember what podcast it was. Anyway, so he, Matthew Garrett, he works, he's had a number of jobs and all connected to open source, free software type stuff. He's working for Core OS right now. And so I guess they're working on an operating system that it's more secure than others. Right? And so he knows all about security. And so this is going to be a minor find. Oh, there's a picture of him. but basically, the depths to which you have to go to make sure that your system is secure are unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah. And the work he's doing sounds really fantastic. And what's really interesting is that, you know, we've been all worried about UEFI and how it's going to stop us from having such easy access to computers and installing Linux and so on. And I've installed it. I had to get a new computer for the or the Island CT server that died. And it worked okay. I had a few weird problems, and I don't exactly know what's running in the BIOS and the configuration. I'm still fixing that up and doing different things with it. But basically, the question seems to be, from his point of view, from Matthew Garrett's point of view, is you have to be secure all the way from the ground up, meaning from the second you turn on the switch to you start using a program, every step has to be, it has to be secure in the sense that somehow the procedure has a signature to it that can be checked by something that you get, that's guaranteed to be I don't know how to explain it. It's like you need a system to check these signatures that is itself guaranteed to not have been hacked, right? Somehow. So either it's over a network through a special key or within your own system,
right?
Self-referencing, right? And it's, getting it right is extremely complicated.
So what are some of the things that he says is necessary to do to really protect a system? Like, I know you can't mention them all, but just a few.
Yeah, so the way I understand it is, for example, you turn on the power and your BIOS starts up. So there's firmware on the chips, right? And so somehow that needs to be signed, in quotes, meaning that the process that's running, when it tries to do something with the computer, I guess it sends commands or it sends a certain procedure that the computer has to go through, and that you can take that, the process itself, I'm not sure, and create a hash of it. Like, you remember when we did the MD5 summons? It came up last podcast too, also. And that hash, you have a copy of it, and so you can compare the two and say, okay, yes. No one has tampered with this firmware.
Right.
Because I have the hash and I have it from the manufacturer or something, right? And then, so then that boots up your copy of your bootloader. But how do you know the bootloader is secure?
Right.
So you have a hash for that the firmware does on the bootloader and says, is that correct? And then there's a copy of the hash that you have for the bootloader, and it compares what you get at startup to the hash that you have, and then says, okay, that's good, and goes on to the next step. And it does all of this, supposedly it can do it in like a second. And if at any step one of the hashes doesn't match, then it stops the system. Mm-hmm. And it asks you, do you want to keep going?
Right.
Or not. So, anyway, I just wanted to mention it as a minor find. I read all the way through it. It was really fantastically interesting. Especially all the stuff that was revealed that the governments have been doing to try to force these backdoors into computers and the whole
concept. Like in all systems.
Yeah. Mm. And the concept that if anybody is doing this, then organized crime will be doing it.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Because you can't, you know, you can't have one without the other.
No, not at all.
Okay. Another super, super minor find. There was an article out of, let's see, it was the September 11th Science, and I only looked at the kind of perspective on the research papers, and it was really a neat new form of innate immunity where your cells get infected by a virus. Mm-hmm. And so they know that's it, you know in quotes. And so they insert, is it a protein? It's some kind of an antiviral molecule, or cause it to be inserted inside the virus when it buds off. Mm-hmm. And when the virus infects the next cell, it's also injecting not just its genetic material and proteins, it's also injecting this molecule telling the cell, you've just been attacked.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And it works through the cyclic GMP system. Mm-hmm. And another system called CGAS. Cyclic GMP. Oh, it's one system. AMP synthase. So I don't know much more about it, but it seemed like a neat new way to defend against viruses. So, let's see. This is your major article. Mm-hmm.
Would you like to start with your work first?
Oh, that you've been I had one more week? Minor one.
Okay.
It was about fire management.
Yeah.
And it was about the September 18th. Did you see this one?
No, I did not. I'm curious.
So this one I read all the way through. Basically, it's a policy article. Mm-hmm. And it's saying that we've got a serious problem in our whole concept of how we manage fires. And we've got climate change, supposedly,
right,
that's causing fires to be more frequent. Mm-hmm. But we also have our own policies causing it to be worse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so basically across the world, it seems like underbrush that's flammable is accumulating. And so fires are getting more and more severe. And the reason is that fires are fought when they arrive, right? And so natural fires don't tend to burn through the amount that they normally burn through. Mm-hmm. And which means that the time between fires gets greater, but when you do get a fire, it just covers way more of the countryside because there's so much brush there,
right,
accumulated. And so they're making a big...
Like brush as in like
dead material.
Dead material. Okay.
That should have been burnt.
Okay.
By previous fires, but the fire never got to it because of control efforts. So it's not like overall you're going to stop fires from going over areas. What you're going to do is you're going to make it that when there are fires, they're going to get more and more
sustain themselves.
More difficult to control.
Right. They'll sustain themselves easily because of the amount of biomass
they'll burn a lot hotter and they'll hit larger areas. And one of the interesting things they said is that because of this situation, fires crown out or something. Basically, natural fires in normal environments where the fires are allowed to burn, which is not necessarily something that can be done, but since there's less brush, you get lots of burning low down, but it's not as hot, doesn't reach as high, and the really big trees, they survive. They don't get burnt.
Really? Yeah. I thought that it would get hot enough along the, you know, up 10 feet from the ground, that it would kind of fry their internal, you know, system of carrying water and whatever.
They're saying that normal fires, that's not what happens.
Wow, so the their bark trees protects them, or the girth protects them that much.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But I had nowadays, no idea. Fires, they reach all the way up. And the crowns of the trees catch on fire.
Mm.
And then it goes from tree to tree like that, and all the trees die.
Wow. So,
anyway, so it was a really interesting article with this phenomenon that I hadn't heard
about. Okay, so you have a state park with, you know.
So they're proposing to divide up areas into three zones.
Yeah.
You have areas close to residential areas, for example. Mm-hmm. So there, you don't ever have fires, and you have mechanical removal of...
Okay,
right?
Got it.
Extremely expensive, but guaranteed to be safe.
Right.
And then intermediate zones, you have prescribed burns, like we have at Pilot Mountain over here in North Carolina,
which
and
sometimes
a few other places.
Gets a little crazy.
Which gets a bit out of control, but, you know, to a certain extent, you've got to think, if you do it more...
Right, you won't.
Maybe you wouldn't ever have the problem.
Yeah.
You know, because was it last year that it went out of control and burned?
The year before.
Was it the year before?
It left a scar for 2 years.
Yeah. Well, you can still see.
Yeah. You
can,
but.
It's not the way it was.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But at the same time, you're starting to see the smaller foliage come back, which didn't appear the first year.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So in those places, you have the prescribed burns, and then further out, so that's expensive, but it's not as expensive as mechanical removal.
Got it.
And mechanical removal isn't really necessarily as good for the environment, because some areas need the heat of the fires. And then you have remote areas, and there they're saying, unless it gets really out of control, natural fires, you just monitor them.
Oh, wow.
And you just let them burn.
Hmm.
So, So, it was interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting. I, you know.
And, you know, they go all into the psychology of why are we in this situation, right?
Right.
You see beautiful woods that a lot of money was put. Like, a lot of money gets put into conservation of areas and stuff, and then all of it goes up in smoke.
Right.
And it's hard for a ranger or a forest manager to be like, yeah, let's just let it burn.
Just let it burn when you've, protected that land and made sure that people were caring for it.
And money is appropriated by Congress to the parks specifically for fighting fires.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's money there. But if you want to do prescribed burns or removal stuff, you have to do it out of your own parks budget.
Oh, so they have to start changing their whole philosophy of how they're funding those prescribed burns.
It has
burns.
To be totally different.
Right.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
Okay. Neat. Yeah. It would take a whole thought process, a changing, for that to occur.
Okay, there's nothing open here, so let me close this. See, I think that's all I had for miners. There's one other thing I wanted to see. Oh, I'm going to do this last.
Okay.
Hide it. Because so I'm going to blindside you. I don't know. This is kind of a minor, the Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to do that, the Joe Mole, who has the homingin.com website,
right,
just put out the pictures from the 2015 championships in Colorado, mm-hmm, for ARDF, and then you got to see them.
Right.
So I don't know. Did you have any thoughts?
Yeah. So there's a lot of planning that has to go into this.
Yeah.
Where
huge.
If you haven't done ARDF, one of the things that they have to have is a huge zone just to put the radios on, so where they're compounded. And how long are they compounded for, your radios?
Oh, you meant...
Your receivers, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. You mean impounded.
Impounded, sorry.
Yeah. Impound is basically to prevent cheating.
Mm-hmm.
It's you walk to an area,
mm-hmm,
where you're going to start the competition with,
yeah,
your radios off, and then everybody puts their radio down on that, on a piece of canvas or,
right,
plastic, whatever. And then everybody moves back away from the start area, and groups of four or five,
mm-hmm,
sometimes three, are called up according to a list,
right,
which only sends out people
on different...
So they're not in the same category, so they're not,
okay,
competing with each other.
Got it.
And they might have to go to different areas, mm-hmm, possibly depending on the type of competition. And when they called up, then you pick up your radio, and you can't turn it on until the beep starts and you run off. So if you're in the first group, you might have it impounded for just, you know, 20 minutes or so for the, waiting for the competition to start. If you're in the last group, you might be waiting there for an hour or,
wow,
or two,
mm-hmm,
hours for the whole, you know, thing
to
go through.
Get going.
Yeah. If you're in the last group, you know.
Neat.
Maybe not two, but, you know, it could,
right,
be an hour.
Well, it takes a while to put people out and to send people out in sections like that.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when you have just a whole ton of people.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So the area they were in, there wasn't much underbrush. It looks like more of...
It's pretty open. Yeah.
More like savanna,
mm-hmm,
that you are running around in.
Yep.
And a very beautiful area. It's just, it's different than what I expected. I expected a lot more forest land.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, we're out in the sun a lot more than at orienteering events,
mm-hmm,
here. Anyway,
yeah,
so I just thought it'd be a fun thing to mention.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and a huge Chinese group. Like, you don't really appreciate the number of kids that they had there.
Until you see the,
yeah,
pictures.
and what's, I noted from the pictures, the kids, you know, their pictures, they always have their feet off the ground.
Uh-huh.
Where the adults have, you know, 1 foot solid on the ground most of the time. The kids, you know, sometimes have both feet.
Both feet off the ground. Yeah, we're going through them now, and it's like two in a row.
Yeah.
There's another one. He's,
yeah,
just barely got a heel on the ground.
Right. And it's just funny to see. It's like, wow, they were cruising.
So, oh, there's two in a single picture. Both, mm-hmm, of them feet off the, both feet,
right,
off the ground.
Right. It was just funny when I was going through. I was like noticing, and a lot of people with circular.
Yeah, the loop.
The
type
loop.
Of,
yeah.
Yeah.
Not very many people have the rod.
The little rod. Yeah.
Yeah.
All the Chinese had rods.
Did they?
Yep. Yeah. Oh. Although, I think they have kind of like one type that they use for 80 meter and one type they use for 2 meter, and everybody gets them.
Yeah.
I think both of them can be just as good one as the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality depends more on other parts of the receiver.
I really want to try the loop just to see what it's like.
A lady from Moldova. We had lots, mm-hmm, from... Lots of people from Moldova.
Neat.
Yeah. So.
Nice.
Anyway, so, yeah. Nice to have the pictures up. I'm going to close this. I think that's all of our minor stuff.
Neat.
I don't see anything in your podcast notes. Other. Okay, so major topics.
Okay.
What first?
So I was...
Do the plumes first?
Do the plumes, because I don't think I'm going to be as long as you.
Okay.
And I think it'll be pretty cool to finish up with what you have.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is what we both have.
Right, right. So... I found this article actually 2 weeks ago.
I saw it too.
Yeah.
And I just, and I really thought it'd be interesting, and I never had a chance to even start it
right.
until you just told me.
Right. And
read this.
So I noticed it 2 weeks ago, and I actually was going to talk about it in the last podcast, and mm-hmm. then I didn't get a chance to read it right before because it had come out right before our podcast. So it's mantle plumes seen rising from Earth's core. So apparently there's been a hot debate in the geoscience, among geoscientists, about whether Earth's hot spots are caused by bulges upward from the mantle, or if they are caused by plumes. Or columns of hot rock that rise from the core. And that's like nearly 3,000 kilometers. So we have these huge plume areas going right from the core up to up through the mantle to the upper mantle, the asthenosphere. So really... it was kind of neat the way they got their data. They did find that, yes, indeed, we have plumes or columns that move up through the, from the core, through the mantle, originating at the core. And it was seismologists that looked at, these earthquake waves, and they're like MRIs, and they give you a tomography of the planet. So every yeah. time we have an earthquake, they look to see how it's traveling through, and then they can determine what the material is it's
right.
moving through.
They call it seismic tomography.
Yeah, seismic tomography. Yeah. And then they could determine, wow, with these hot spots, they're lower density, and determine that, you know, there was actually the plumes form throughout
right.
The mantle. So I thought it was really neat. And what I thought was really interesting is that the amount of computer power it took. And I'm looking for it right now. It's like they had to use supercomputers.
Yeah,
to
the Hopper.
The Hopper. And it was so funny because, you know, it brought back War Games.
Yeah, what was it called in War
it
Games?
It was Whopper.
Whopper, the Whopper, yeah.
So I'm like, oh, it's the Hopper. Yeah. Okay, so they had to use the Hopper, and it took 3 million computer hours on the Department of Energy supercomputer.
Yeah, or an equivalent. I think it has to do with the number of processes it's running.
Yeah, so to get this information. Yeah. So I definitely a great find and something that's been controversial.
It sounds pretty solid.
Yeah, it yeah. sounds solid. They do have a few people that are skeptics. One in particular that was mentioned is Jillian
yeah.
Folger.
I didn't totally understand looking at the data. She was saying that there's problems, like you don't get much data out of the oceans.
Right.
And I'm looking at the graph, I mean the map, right? And
right.
it shows where the plumes are. And it looks like actually most of them are over the ocean.
Right. And that's what I didn't understand either. Because, you know, if you think of the Ring of Fire and that... You have a huge area where you have...
well, they don't seem to...
Well, it's not around there.
Is
sorry,
this thing,
actually.
Is that the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, or is that further
yeah,
to the left? I mean,
yeah.
I don't... There's a lot of, right, the Canaries are around there.
No, you're
and
right,
stuff.
You're right.
I don't think so, those are necessarily part of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
No, they aren't. They aren't.
And then there's these in the mid-South Pacific?
Right.
I assume these are all from seismic stations. Maybe that's what it is they're all on islands, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, if it's islands, because we do not see, like, the more traditional areas where we have a lot of plate movement.
Yeah, like, that's right.
You know, you don't see the Ring of Fire or anything marked.
No, you don't.
They're slightly off of that.
Yeah.
So
actually, totally. When you think the Ring of Fire, that would be
right here.
Up.
Yeah. Right here.
Well, it'd be here.
Right.
It'd be up Asia, the east coast of Asia, Japan, Indonesia, right?
Yeah.
Up southern Alaska, western Canada, western U.S., down. It's the whole surrounding the
Pacific.
Isn't that
the
Anyway, yeah.
So, interesting find, and I just thought...
So did you pick up on why it was so computationally intensive?
No, I did not. Did you?
Yeah, the way I understand it is...
You have to explain that.
You get an earthquake, right?
Right.
And you get all these waves that go out.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see when the waves start from the earthquake, and then from different stations around where they arrive, you measure how long it takes for them to get... Oh, you got a picture of the Ring of Fire. Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Aleutians.
Right.
Japan, Kamchatka,
and
Java.
And it goes back here a bit, too. Mm-hmm. Around Java.
What's this over here? Just north of... Oh, I can't remember.
Is it like the Christmas Island?
No, this is a big island. This is where, what's his name, who wrote The Third Chimpanzee?
Oh,
used to go to...
Trying to see.
Yeah, this island there.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I can name on it. Anyway.
Yeah, and west coast of South America, Peru, Chile. Yeah. Oh, all the way down to New Zealand.
Yep. New Zealand has it has a lot of activity.
Yeah.
That's actually why we're down there with the Margins Grant.
Right, right.
Is because of the plate movement along the coast of New Zealand.
Anyway, so the waves start coming from the earthquake, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they travel through the earth and they hit different spots around the earth where you have seismic stations.
Mm-hmm.
So you can figure out where it came from.
Right.
And you can figure out, well, where did it slow down? And is it right? It slowed down or it slows down when it reaches less dense and hotter areas.
Right.
Okay. So, which I thought was kind of strange because the plumes, they were talking about having really dense basaltic material.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's not go into that because I don't think we know much about this. But the point is, that's the way it used to be done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you see when it arrives. What they're doing is, when it arrives, all the data of the vibrations going up and down that come after that, they also analyze all of that.
Right.
So when before each station you had like one number, now you have an entire wave. And it's probably one of those, you know, problems that increases in complexity in an exponential way with how many different points of data that you're trying to put together, because the waves you have to match against each other, I guess. And so that's why it was so computationally expensive.
Very interesting article.
Right.
Really cool design, I think,
for
how they came up with how to.
And I think the real major finding, I mean, there was a lot of evidence for plumes, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the really major finding is that the plumes, we couldn't see all the way to the core.
Right.
There was no evidence of that right before. And now it seems pretty solid from what most of the geophysicists are saying.
Right.
That, yes, they're from all the way from the very boundary of the core in the mantle. That's where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
And also, that they're humongous, like more than three times larger in diameter than the original theories were saying, right?
Right.
Which means that before we thought, oh, there's a lot of convection in the lower core, and that brings heat up to the surface.
Right.
And because they're so huge at the core,
the convection currents don't even touch them.
Well, it might not even be that. It might,
or don't affect them, I should say.
No, but it might be their, our whole theory might be incorrect about there being even any convection currents.
Right.
Because they're bringing so much heat up from the core. Maybe that's all there is at the bottom, right?
Yeah.
Maybe this is non-existent, is one of the hypotheses now.
Right.
That at the lowest levels of the, the core of the mantle.
Right.
Closest to the core, that maybe there's actually almost no convection down there.
Right. And then.
Because they were straight.
Yeah.
Right down there.
Yeah.
They only tended to move sideways due to motion when they reached the very top.
Right.
So if they're absolutely straight at the bottom, that's maybe another indication that maybe there's like almost no convection down there. So.
Yeah. And it was mentioned in the article that, you know, that is something that they have to look into, is looking at the density and consistency of different parts of the mantle. Maybe they have to rethink what they were.
Yeah, right.
Their
exactly.
earlier hypothesis.
Exactly.
About
yeah.
that. So it's really fascinating, and it'll be interesting to see how they collect data about the materials in the mantle.
Yeah.
And
one thing that was really cool is, I mean, they're going to work at the main thing they got out of this in terms of data is more precision, right?
Right.
It was more detailed, the picture they could see. And they're going to try to make it even more detailed.
Right.
And one of the things I think is cool is this idea that, you know, when you have two plates meeting and one's going underneath the other, we actually don't know what happens as it goes down below. We don't know if it's just going down a little bit or if it's going down really,
really deep.
Deep,
yeah.
And in the next iteration, they think they're going to be able to figure this out.
Right. Maybe. And I think that's really cool because I've always wondered about that. I'm like, so actually, how deep is that?
I never even thought about it. I always assumed that it goes down and it like melts right away.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, just from pictures I've seen.
Right.
This is not something
from
I thought about.
From the pictures, definitely.
This is not something I thought about deeply at all. It's just I've always assumed that because I've always seen those pictures in books.
Right. Right. Exactly. Okay. So I just thought it was a very interesting article.
I think there's even more that's interesting.
Yes.
Did you see the bottom there?
I didn't get down to the bottom of
it. Oh, do you want me to tell you about this?
Sure. Tell me about it.
So one of the guys who was really thinking this was cool.
Mm-hmm.
In the main article, I don't know if you came across this guy from a university in France. Can't remember. This bottom article, this side article, is about him, Gust Nollet, N-O-L-E-T.
Yeah.
And do you remember the movie about the tornadoes?
Yes.
Where he makes... Okay, so this guy has come up with a whole bunch of these robots. Well, they're not really robots. They're basically submersibles, right? They just float randomly. They don't have any direction. They go down deep in the water, and then they just listen for the sound waves that P waves cause from earthquakes when they hit the interface between the ocean and the ocean floor. Unfortunately, no other types of seismic waves produce acoustic sounds, so they can only tell stuff from P waves, right? And it's about getting to this problem that the one skeptic was talking about. We don't have good data from the ocean,
right?
And getting data, going on boats is extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So he sends them all out. He sent them out in the Mediterranean, the Indian Ocean, and the Pacific, and they basically go down deep, and then they just listen. And after a while, they come back up, and they transmit what they've heard by satellite.
Oh, neat.
And the data is really coarse still because you can't tell where they are.
Right.
Until they come back up.
Right.
So they don't even know where they are.
So they have a GPS device that tracks them. Yep. And then they use that information and along with the different kinds of probes that they have connected to them.
Exactly.
That are measuring the P waves.
Exactly.
Neat.
Yeah.
Very cool.
They measure the P waves. They can tell when, you know, how loud the sounds were from P waves at a particular time. But they don't know where they are. But when they get back to the surface, they knew where they were when they were at the surface last.
Neat.
And they know where they are when they get back to the surface and send their data back about what they heard. Yeah. And so the one you're looking up here.
Are these gliders?
No. So
okay.
All of this article up to here. So that's 3/4 of the article.
I saw scripts, so I was curious.
No, that's a different one.
Okay.
So yeah. So up to 3/4 of the article is about Nollet, who's out of France.
Mm-hmm.
University of Nice, Sophia Antipolis. Mm-hmm. And then the last little part, so he's published about this, when he's found. He's the one who calls his
instruments
mermaids, and I was groaning
at
the name. Let me see. Mobile earthquake recording in marine areas by independent divers. mermaids is the acronym. And then the last part that you were underlining here is Jonathan Berger.
Mm-hmm.
So he's at Scripps.
Yep.
And he's designed these, what he calls gliders.
Right.
And they surf. And so they're more like robots. They can be sent out from the shore. They collect data and then they come back.
Right. I've heard about the gliders.
I didn't.
And I've seen saved them, but I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I was like, whoa, they're using gliders for this too.
This is really taking off in science, these systems of collecting data where you send out autonomous entities that kind of act as a swarm in getting you information rather than humongous expensive. So the mermaids are $30,000 each and the gliders are $200,000 each. That kind of makes sense for their the way you think of their cost differential, I mean.
Right.
For the design. Anyway.
Neat.
I just thought it was really cool.
That is. I think that's really cool. I think that's just neat combination of, you know, developing an investigation that you want to get more information about seismic waves or the mantle or mantle plumes.
Yep.
And then combining it with wonderful electronics to collect the data.
Wouldn't it be cool to do you remember a few years ago, you were designing these little robots with the kids. You were testing them in the pool.
Yeah, we're going over to the pool.
Yeah.
And we would do these things.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it'd be cool to have these, to get a project, like, I think we're good for how much we've taken on for the next year at least.
Yeah.
But a possible future one is to bring that project back, but to put them on with data loggers, right?
Right.
To have 3 or 4 and send them out in a local lake or something.
Right.
And they can record their depth and what they're sensing and stuff. Like you have oxygen sensors.
But you wouldn't want to have tethered ones. You want them to be more autonomous.
Yeah, you want them to go out.
Yeah.
Do this kind of random search and then come back.
Right.
And then you have the data loggers and you can have kind of like a 3D view of what the lake was from your robots.
Because we had tethered ones. And so it limited us.
Right.
You know, and we were going to take it to the coast.
Oh.
But we were afraid to because...
You didn't want to lose it.
Well, you get out there with a group of kids that haven't been doing a fresh or saltwater marsh.
Uh-huh.
And they're so excited. and we're afraid the excitement might be the end of the rove, and we wouldn't be able to recover.
That's what they were called, the roves.
Yeah, the roves.
I remember going to the pool with you.
Yep, the kids loved them. And actually,
once or twice.
One of the fathers that helped me do the wiring with a group of kids, his daughter's about to graduate college, and his son just started in the 8th grade, and he's like, so, are we going to do anything like the roves again?
Someday.
No. But I have electronics that we're going to be working on. But it would be neat to go back to someday. Okay.
Okay, yeah.
So
that was one major one.
Let's hear, Pat. What have you been up to?
Well, I have been working like a dog.
You have been. Nonstop.
I get back from work and every day I work full steam on this to make this happen. So we have, you had your first Avatar Club
meeting today.
Today. Mm-hmm. And you guys did some stuff. And not this weekend, but the weekend after. Is that right? Is the next one?
Right.
And we're trying to get an Art of kind of club type thing.
Right.
Working on that day.
Right.
And so we needed one more transmitter for that. So they could have two out in the woods and one to understand what's happening and practice with the receivers and stuff.
Right.
And we also want to have one made that we can run full events. Mm-hmm. Then it's got to have several frequencies available. So I don't know, I think we've talked about using the SI-5351.
Right.
So, right before this podcast at 13:10 today, it finally was finished. It is built.
Yay!
And with your help, you did some soldering last night for me.
Yep.
So what does that mean it's built? This is a prototype. It fits in a plastic box that's a bit, it's about the size of a shoebox.
Right.
It's all in modules. Mm-hmm. The modules have all been tested independently, and some of them have been tested together, but we've never had the whole thing working.
Right.
All at once. So that's, I'm going to be working on the code in the next week. And hopefully get it to work. But we don't have to get the full thing working.
No.
We just need it to work enough as a demonstration thing because we're going to use the microfoxes for the actual going out in the woods and stuff and doing ARTIF. But what's different about this one is instead of using the older system, which used... BFS-17 is the main transistor for the amplifier. It's using an IRF-610 and with a driver in front of it. And so we should be able to put out a lot more power, probably more than a watt, maybe up to 3 if we want to.
That's wonderful.
So this should have the power to be used with a real... You know, any any international events would not need as much power as we have.
How does it compare to the one that we would take out and test together?
I think more than 10 times the power.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. That's really good.
Because I think we had like something like 100 milliwatts or so.
Right.
Or less.
Right.
And this is going to be more than a watt.
So what Pat didn't tell you about the device that he just built, the transmitter, is that he built it in modules? So all these modules...
No, I said so.
Did you say that?
And that they're being tested.
Yeah, separately.
They were all tested separately and some in combination.
Yeah. So, and what's really cool is these modules are going to be combined together on a Parks board that you're going to create after.
So that's why it was so important to have everything really well tested in this prototype version. Is because we're going to have everything done on a single board built by Oshpark and sent to us, and then we'll put it all together. And it'll definitely be smaller than a shoebox then.
It will be. But I really like the design that you came up with.
Yeah.
So he has the modules all put together on a piece of plexiglass.
Yep.
So they're all connected on a piece of plexiglass. And they have spacers to hold them up off of the plexiglass so that there's room to look under for wires and that to make sure everything's connected. It gives it a lot of mobility, so you can take off one part and look at it, change up things, put it back on. Also, the batteries are underneath that plexiglass piece.
Yeah.
So they're there, they're within the box, but they aren't in the way.
Right.
And it's hard to have space for batteries, and it's all in a shoebox. So He's going to be using it for the first time with a group of eighth graders.
Yeah.
So it's protected, you know.
So I think I want to mention, yeah, it's, okay, so two things. Actually, before I move on, it's neat because if anyone's interested, they can, we can open it up,
right.
And it's like all in separate pieces, these modules, so
right.
You can explain it very easily.
What each one means,
yeah, exactly.
And how it works.
Yeah.
And I really like that idea because it gives you like a clear visual. So this component does this. This component,
yeah,
does that. And I know it's helped me a lot to understand what each one does,
right,
and how it works with the rest.
Yeah. And they're arranged in kind of a flow of information,
right,
type arrangement.
Yeah.
Most of them.
I love it because it's big.
Yeah.
But it's framed in a shoebox, so it's handy.
So it's
a plastic
humongous
shoebox, so it's not, yeah, humongous. But it's a great way to design things at a, you know, on a macro scale before you put it in a micro,
yep,
scale,
yep,
of a parks board.
Yeah. And so, you know, the driver module, as an example, the first one didn't work.
No.
And it's sitting on the table over there. And I pulled it and I redesigned it.
Right.
And tried a new one. And we were just saying, do we use the Adafruit Breakout SI5351 boards?
Right.
Or do we design the SI5351 chip from Silicone Labs directly into the Oshpark boards? And I think that's kind of where we're going.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I think so.
Maybe we want to design our own first. We can just pull the module that's in there out,
mm-hmm,
put ours in,
mm-hmm,
right, which has been soldered onto our own breakout board, and see how well it works integrated in the system. And,
mm-hmm,
then we know even before we send it away to Oshpark.
Right.
So it's really handy way to, mm-hmm, test things out, to have it in this modular system. And yeah, so I'm really happy with it.
I think it's, yeah, just a cool way to go in designing a project.
Yeah. So I want to mention three names.
Mm-hmm.
The transmitters, I mean, it took me a while to get to this stage, and these are very simple transmitters,
mm-hmm,
but, and a lot of it I designed myself,
mm-hmm,
looking at, you know, different possibilities and coming up with the ideas, but a lot of the original work on the MicroFoxes, the design originally came from Jerry Boyd,
mm-hmm,
and he really helped me out a lot.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Dale Hunt at the time, I was also working on receivers, which I'll get back to, and he helped out also. Not as directly with the transmitters,
mm-hmm,
but he was handy. And then this one, the design for the power amplifier and the filter. So the filter I designed myself for the MicroFox, but this,
nice,
one is the one that came from Rick Strobe. And
right.
I have not met him, and I do not know him. He's in Europe. But it's basically mostly his design for the power amplifier and the filter, which I'll have to see if mine, if I can just flip it in and see how different it,
right,
is. The driver is, because he uses a crystal and I wanted to have the versatility of the SI5351, I had to alter the crystal, and so that's totally different. And anyway, so that's where the information came from.
Great.
And so, yeah, that's what's been taking up all my time, and boy, it's nice that it's finally built. And we will be testing it out in the next,
right,
little while.
Right.
And hopefully in 2 weeks, we'll... That'll be neat. Let me see. Thursday. We'll have one podcast right before...
Right.
That one.
Yep.
So by that time, we'll have more information about how it performs.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff. Okay.
So nice.
So that's pretty much everything. I have some wrapping up stuff that I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
Do you have anything else?
The thing that you were hiding, you mean earlier?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes. Do you have anything else, though?
No, I do not.
Okay. So that's his. I was going over some of our older podcasts, and I remember you said just like 3 weeks ago or so, 2 weeks ago, something like that, that you had finally started the makerspace at school. And that you were really excited because you'd said, yeah, I want to start it in September, but then the school year starts.
Yeah.
And yep, it really did get started in
September. Second week of school. We were doing it.
So, I mean, and I remember the kids were pestering you. Are you going to have it?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was listening to podcast 10, going over for notes and stuff, and I came across this. You were talking about writing with the AVID system about your kids, so I want to get back to that.
Oh, yeah.
And about the makerspace and the kids that had been in there, having a lot of them having been the kids that got increased scores on the tests, the standardized tests, right? There were four students, and you had said, this is way back in podcast 10, I need to make sure it happens in September. This was before the summer, and I'd totally forgotten about this. And here it is.
Yeah.
Just September 26th, and it's happened.
Oh, that's fun.
So, isn't that fun? Yeah.
Not only that, we've been pushing the writing part. Yeah.
So, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I faintly remember about you. I didn't get a chance to get through all of it, but you'd mentioned the AVID writing, and it was a system, if I remember correctly, where you really direct the kids.
Right. It's called the meal.
Yeah. Anyway, one thing I wanted to ask you about is, if you think back about this and the fact that we were sitting here together and you were working grading these assignments they've done.
Yeah.
And
like that
the
word
stuff
not
that was being
so
written
good.
Was just horrendous.
Oh, it was awful.
And it was about writing.
Yeah.
Right? And I was thinking about, then I came across you talking about AVID. And although I don't totally understand the AVID system, so like say something.
Okay. Like, so we are continuing using the AVID system
that
for
really
writing.
Help?
Oh,
for that type of problem?
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
But our students haven't received a lot of feedback, like direct feed. They haven't had a specific direction in their writing and specific feedback, whether they've accomplished it or haven't.
You mean in past years?
In past years.
Okay. Yeah.
And so this has been a little bit of a shock for them. And when they're...
So did you go to them and say, this is unacceptable? Like,
yes,
what
I did.
You did, yeah?
I did. I said, this is unacceptable.
I didn't hear about this.
And we did, we had four different examples.
Yeah.
We had one good one, one bad one, or no,
oh, cool.
one good
yeah,
one,
that's
three bad ones. And then they'd do four corners of the room.
Uh-huh.
Would you give it a one, two, three, or a four, right? Then the kids would go to different parts if they would give it partial credit, full credit. And then they would say why they didn't give it. And I'm like, okay, so you are giving it because you didn't include, you know, the nerd word in your sentence, which was part of the task to use your
part
vocabulary.
Of the assignments, right.
Yeah. And you didn't show me that you understood the word by giving some kind of example to showcase your understanding.
Uh-huh.
And so then they started telling me all this, and I'm like, really?
Let's go over your assignment. What did you actually write?
But the next one that came in.
Was it better?
It was much better. And the kids just didn't know what to do. So, and I told them, I said, look, for the first few, you get a low grade. I'm going to put specifically why you're getting that low grade.
Right.
If you come in and clean it up at lunch, I will put it up to full.
Cool.
Because I want them to learn.
So you've actually had another assignment since then.
Oh, yeah.
And it came back a lot better.
Yeah, it came back a lot better. Yeah. So the second nerd word, that's why I didn't see it at home. I graded it at school.
It was easier to grade. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I...
No, are you doing the AVID system for kids where you do this very strong direction?
For the meal paragraph?
Just in general with your kids now.
We've started the meal at the beginning of the year. They've done one that I still have to get through.
What's the meal?
It's like main idea, use evidence to support your main idea.
Gotcha.
Analysis, and then you link to, you know, back to the main idea.
Okay.
Of why you wrote that paragraph.
Okay.
So, for example, you know, Bowling Creek has great water quality.
Right.
We got 6.8 in our pH reading.
So it's a handy little
system
of pegs that they can check through to make sure that they're making any kind of sense whatsoever in their argument.
And next year when they go into high school, they'll have this go-to.
Right.
And they can.
Well, I mean, hopefully.
Hopefully they can grow from that.
Exactly. They can grow from that, right? It's like if they're having trouble doing anything that makes any sense. And they start writing.
Right.
Because it's a question of spending time doing writing.
Right.
And then they go through that, then it becomes second nature.
Yeah.
And then they can start modifying it for their different purposes, or their style might change. And
right. And so I had something cool happen. So I got observed. Yeah. I think I told you about that observation. I said, it's not going to go so well. It was kind of...
Yes. I do remember.
It was chaotic and crazy. And I had to talk to people across the room. I had to show them how to do the water quality test.
I remember.
So I'm doing self-directing with swans, self-yelling with others.
Self-yelling.
No.
Yelling across the room.
Yelling across the room.
You,
what are you doing?
What are you doing?
No. Anyway, so I had this whole thing. Well, in the center of my room, he's working with a group of students and asking them about it, and they had to write a group meal. So they wrote an individual meal, and they were writing a group meal.
Right.
And the kids had very specific things that they had to put in it.
Yeah.
And so he goes, well, I read their meal. And then I said, but what does this mean? And the kids go, it means. And then they could tell him what it means. He goes, I asked them four probing questions, and they were able to answer each one. And when they looked at me, they're like, don't you know that? And so he was really impressed. And actually, my observation, he said, went really well.
Cool.
And so it was just nice to see that the kids are starting to realize this is a tool of communication and a way of communicating clearly to others. That's all.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So that's all I wanted to ask you about, is just about the AVID and writing, because I remembered that assignment.
Yeah.
And also about just noting that it's fun, that you had said way back at podcast 10.
Yeah.
We're on what podcast?
We're on 19, and our next one will be 20.
Yeah. And you had said way back then, I need to make sure it happens in September, about the makerspace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Very exciting. That's good.
I think this might be everything.
I think we've covered everything. Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Future plans?
Yep. So, future plans. And I have down ARDF at Okinichi State Park.
Oh, that's right. We're going to Okinichi this
time.
Okay. Hopefully.
So,
unless it rains out.
Unless it gets poured out.
Then we'll try it at school.
And then we'll have to do one at school, which may have so-so effect. Yeah. And website. We're just going to make it happen. High five, Pat. We're making it happen.
We're making it happen, yeah. No, but I mean, I think the ARDF was the important thing right now.
Right.
We worked really hard.
Yeah.
To make that happen.
Right.
And it looks like it's built.
Right.
So, I mean, there's still a few things to... I mean, I have to write the code. That's...
Mm-hmm.
But, it's not... It's putting it together.
Right.
Because we have the code for the SI5351 that's been tested.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked. And we have the code from the microfoxes. And it works.
Right.
That's what's running the microfoxes now. So... It's just a question of putting the two together and changing the configuration to match the new hardware, you know, where the switches are on what pins.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the first one we've built with an Oshkosh board.
Yes, it is.
That is really cool.
With the first Oshkosh board. Oshkosh. No, that's a close. Oshkosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so those are the future plans.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing much else. but that's a lot.
It is.
Should we wrap it up?
I think it's time for the wrap up.
So thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.